I still remember when I was 8. There was a toy that I saw that I wanted to have. I really wanted it. It was a little bit unusual, maybe, so my parents weren't particularly keen on getting me this toy, but I really wanted it. I really wanted it. I really wanted it. So they got it to me for me for Christmas. I opened the package and I was so happy to get it. And that's the last I had anything to do with it. I never played with it, never was interested in it again. Somehow the illusion, the fantasies, the allure, the advertisements, whatever for it, kind of had gotten my imagination and how wonderful it was going to be, how great it was going to be, but then the actual reality of it was, you know, just didn't do anything for me. And you might be happy to know what it was that didn't do anything for me. It was a toy machine gun. Somehow that got into my head that this would be the thing to have. But then having it, the interest in it, the illusions, the enchantment in it, whatever it would do, I don't know what it was, but it was gone. Maybe you've had something like that, where you had something, put great value in something, you had imagined it, it's going to be fantastic, be really wonderful. And then you did it. And, you know, it was... wasn't so wonderful. Something, you know, it just didn't live up to the hype. Sometimes people plant illusions, delusions in our mind, politicians, and sometimes we or some people believe them, and they're just constructs, ideas, but sometimes we invest a lot of authority in some people, like they know, or a lot of power or status compared to us. And then something happens and it goes away. Sometimes we see their human side, perhaps, or we see that we had projected it onto them, and that we were living in some kind of illusion, idea. And sometimes it takes years for some of these bubbles, these ideas to pop, and we no longer see through that lens. But what we realize is how much we've been seeing through a lens that we constructed, maybe with the help of society. And we can be living in illusions, living in delusions, living in an enchantment. It's still meaningful for me, the experience I had many years ago when I was at the meditation hall at Green Gulch Zen Center. And the rule back then was that it was very strict. That the way the altar was situated, let me tell you this, the way it's situated here. It was like this one here, except there was a space behind it you could walk. And we were never, ever supposed to walk across the midline right in front of the Buddha. You had to go always behind to get to the other side. And I was a new student, and I took this seriously, and there were times where we had to, for some reason, I had really got close to that line, and it was like a force field. Like, I could feel the force. Like, I couldn't, I shouldn't be any closer. That's enough. I couldn't cross that. I don't know, something would happen, but it was a force field that repelled me. And I lived with that. It was very matter of fact to live with that. No thoughts about it. I just thought, yeah. And then one day I was in that meditation hall, kind of off to the corner and back corner. And there were Buddhist tourists who came in, tourists who just came to see Green Gulch. They were just walking around, and they didn't know anything about a line down the middle. And they were talking in the meditation hall, just crossed that line as if it was not there. As if it was not there. And nothing happened to them. Nothing, it's just like it was nothing. And something just like, my mind just like, wow, it doesn't exist. The force field was a projection of my own mind. I said, wow, my mind is powerful to imagine, so strong that I actually could feel like I'm getting close, and like, better step back. And then, it's very even stranger, since then, I've gone back to give a Dharma talk, and now they've changed things around, and I couldn't believe it. They put the seat for the Dharma talk teacher smack on that line. You're directly in front of the Buddha, right? You're looking at the Buddha, like, what am I doing sitting on this? This is crazy. This is not right. So I was living in a kind of an illusion. It was socially created, an idea, but I took it on myself and built it up in my mind and created this whole world that seemed so real. And just some people walking across the floor was enough to just pop the bubble. And wow, I saw that was quite fun. And I've done that to people. I've projected onto people all kinds of things on them. Probably you name it, I've done it. So I don't have to give you examples. And then I've gotten to know them. Sometimes they're so much more wonderful than I thought. Sometimes they're so much more ordinary than I thought. Sometimes something else. But I could see I had a whole fantasy idea that I built up. There is something called, that's probably, we all know this, but there's something called Vipassana romances. That's when we fall in love with someone on a retreat. And without even talking to them. So I was at the 3-month retreat at IMS. It's a long time. And I had a Vipassana romance for a woman there. That the romance was very successful. Because I had 3 months for it. And in that course of that time, we met, we spent time together, did wonderful things together, we got married, we had children. It was quite a wonderful romance. And it wasn't like I was doing it all the time, but it was kind of like a little thread that was running through here and there. And I guess it was building, and it was quite lovely. And and then when the retreat came to an end, I think we had like a big kind of closing circle of some kind, and everyone was going to speak. And so she spoke. And she had has a really thick French accent. And my whole fantasy was based on her being an American. And in that moment, I saw it all, the fantasy just crumbled. It was like, wow, Gil, what were you doing? What were you? You know, wow. And one more story, when I was at, you know, this was kind of very humbling in many ways, but so I spent 3 years living at the Zen monastery in Tassajara. And I spent a year working in the kitchen. I didn't want to be in the kitchen, but I got into it and loved it. And I was kind of a kitchen manager type person running the kitchen for a while, for quite a while that year. And in the summer months, they used to have a guest season. People would come and be guests there, and they would cook these elaborate meals for the guests. So there was a whole set of cooks that just cooked for the guests, a set of cooks that kind of cooked leftovers and things for the students. And I kind of looked around and saw, well, I'm really now the most qualified person to be the guest cook for the next summer. And then, you know, of course they'll choose me. So during the winter for 6 months, we ate most of the meals in this posture, in the meditation hall, kind of meditating if you're not eating and waiting for the food to come. And you're kind of like eating mindfully. And it's quite something to do. But I spend most of the time thinking about menus for the next summer and what I'd do as the, you know, the special guest cook, and evaluating the food that we got, thinking about, you know, how it could be better, or, you know, I was just thinking, because I was certainly going to be. So then at the beginning of that summer, when they were going to announce the jobs, they were going to do it in the meditation hall. Everyone is standing in a circle. So it's kind of a ritual. And they read out a name and the job you'll have. Some people don't know what they're going to do until they have that announcement. So I didn't know what was going to happen. They did not announce me to be the guest cook. And I said, Gil, what were you doing all those months? Like, you wasted your youth. I could have been meditating. I could have been just sitting there and practicing instead of this fantasies and ideas and how wonderful it would be food, food thoughts. I said, wow, that's a long time to be enchanted by something. Then to have it just the rug pulled from under it. Like, wow. I wasn't exactly disappointed. It wasn't like I wasn't crushed or disappointed exactly. It was more like, what have I been doing? Wow. That I'm capable of that? Wow. So the big lesson. So these are all stories of becoming disillusioned in a wonderful way. I think the English word disillusionment has a kind of really heavy, kind of negative feeling, like a big disappointment in something. But if you're living in illusion, disillusionment should be considered, you should celebrate. And sometimes we use in Buddhism the word disenchantment. And I like that word better than disillusionment. But disenchantment implies that you've been enchanted, that you've been under the spell of something, and the spell has been broken. So that's one of the things that this practice of the Dharma sooner or later brings us up against these places where we see our illusions, we see our delusions, we see how we're in the spell of something, and the spell is broken. We are disenchanted. And it's considered to be a very important and mature and important step in the practice for this to happen. And it can happen in, you know, many different ways. Tourists walking across the floor. You know, it didn't take a lot of meditation to see that. But it made a big difference for me. It can also happen in deep meditation, from deep meditation. And that's kind of what the Upanisa Sutta is pointing towards. That It's laying down a series of conditions, starting with suffering, that are the proximate condition, the proximate supporting context for something else to have a chance to happen. So from suffering, there's a healthy, important, direct way of seeing suffering that can give rise to faith. The faith that it's possible to end suffering. Without suffering, why would you want to end it? So you have to have it for that faith. And then there's a gladness, appreciation for having a practice, having a knowledge that this is possible. And there's the joy of doing the practice, the joy and engagement, having good fortune to practice. A lot of people don't have that fortune. There's tranquility, learning how to relax and become calm and settled. That's built on this foundation of gladness and joy and faith. So it says it's qualitatively a particular quality of tranquility with those others as a foundation. And from that foundation, there's happiness. From that, there is a particular quality of samadhi, particular way in which the mind gets gathered and united. You can get really concentrated and united doing even unwholesome things. But this is coming out of this very wonderful, important foundation of this goodness, this warmth, this happiness. And so this gathering, settling, so there's a lot of goodness here, a lot of well-being, a lot of peace. And then we, from there, we're able to see more clearly. There's a kind of the lenses of our eyes get taken off. All the confusion, all the agitation, all the spinning of the mind, all the projections that we kind of come, you know, get quiet enough that we start seeing more clearly. And we have the seeing of becoming, seeing of how things come to be, how they arise. And some of that we see they arise out of conditions. And we see, for example, we look back over this process of Upanisa, that we see, oh yeah, all these things have come into being from conditions before. Particular way they're there. They're not there. You know, I didn't just sit down in a meditation hall one day and snap my fingers and boom, samadhi, boom. No, there was all these conditions in place that really allowed this to happen. And we see that becoming, one thing leads to the other, supports the other. And we see a lot of this becoming. We see how much there is. We see that maybe there's constant becoming, constant change, constant inconstancy. The only thing that's constant is inconstancy. The thing's changing all the time. And that's the condition for a particular dharmic disenchantment. So that's the next step in the Upanisa path, to become disenchanted. And there's a particular, some verses in the Dhammapada that make some very fascinating statements about this disenchantment. The verses go, all mental constructs are impermanent, changing, inconstant. Knowing this, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. And what's strange about this is, disenchanted with suffering? What is that? It implies that there are people in this world, probably nobody here, just to make sure that you're not being judged. There are people in the world who are enchanted with suffering, or have are in the illusion or deluded about suffering, and they're caught in that delusion, caught in that enchantment. All mental constructs are changing and inconstant. Seeing this clearly, one is disenchanted with suffering. All mental constructs are not self. Seeing this clearly, all mental constructs are suffering. Seeing this clearly, one becomes disillusioned with suffering. And then it changes. It doesn't say mental constructs. And next it says dhammas, which I translate as states. All states are not self. Seeing this clearly, one is disillusioned or disenchanted with suffering. And my interpretation of why it goes from mental constructs to all states is that mental constructs are the stories, what we make up in the mind. And usually when we make things up in the mind, there's usually clinging, delusion, illusions, grasping involved in those made-up world we make. So to really see that the mind is doing these things, to really see the mind making things up is quite powerful. And to feel that making things up, making ideas up, stories up, there's suffering there, kind of a strange suffering, suffering based on illusion. Seeing this clearly, one is disillusioned with that suffering. So I've certainly done that in meditation, lived in certain making up worlds of fantasies. And sometimes in longer retreats, it's really obvious that it's exhausting. I've had fantasies that just wouldn't stop for days on long retreats. And I was just begging for it to stop. It was just so tiring. It was so crazy, so much of a fantasy. But to see the mind making these fantasies and living in them, reacting to them, I saw this is suffering. This is not real. And so but most of us live so much in the world of make-believe, made-up world of thoughts. It's phenomenal how much we live in world of making it up, called mental constructs. To see them as inconstant means to see them as something that comes and goes, see that they're no inherent existence, they're no substantial truth to them, they're just phenomena that come and go. And if you see them as coming and going and see them as being stressful to have them, then we don't put a lot of value in them, we don't invest a lot into them. We don't have a lot of attachment to them. We don't have a lot of resistance or antipathy towards them. But then it goes to all states are not self. It doesn't say all states are not suffering. And I take there's a lot of wonderful states, wonderful dhammas, the seven factors of awakening. Our dhammas, our states that are wonderful, and mindfulness and deep, clear discernment, vitality and joy and tranquility, samadhi, equanimity. These aren't made up by the mind. They're not illusions. These are states that are born from within. There are things that arise from within that are not illusions, but natural states. There's even forms of thinking that are not delusive. They don't involve making things up, but involve deep recognition, deep questioning, deep exploration of what is this life we're living. That's a natural way of being present and living in this world. And it's coming from a different source than the mind that makes things up. But even these wonderful states are not self. To see that clearly is to become disillusioned or disenchanted with our suffering, because it's possible to be attached to these wonderful states. It's possible to define oneself by them. And, you know, it's possible to, you know, get into a wonderful meditative state on Tuesday, but the practice discussion with the teacher is on Wednesday. And then Wednesday you don't have that wonderful state. But that was so wonderful to report that. Joseph de Goldstein tells a story of going to Pandita with the report. And Upandita looked at him and something had said, "That's not right. Something's wrong here." Something like that. And so Joseph had to admit, "Well, this was yesterday's report." You're supposed to report about today. But he wanted to get credit for what he did yesterday. So he was attached to his good state of yesterday and wanted to get credit for it, or, you know, or it's kind of frightening. It was kind of scary to go talk to Pandita. So, you know, you want to somehow manage those conversations too. So this fierce general kind of teacher would mostly leave you alone. So as we get quieter and stiller in the practice, we start seeing the birth of thoughts, the birth of ideas. It's possible to see what wasn't there, and you see an idea, the becoming of an idea, the coming of a thought. And this is a powerful position from which to see our life, rather than the thoughts arising kind of out of sight, and they're just there, and we're in the thoughts, and thoughts provide us with the interpretation of our world, the projections of what's there, and we believe it. Our interpretations, our opinions, and that clearly must be true since I'm thinking it. But to watch a thought arise makes us so much more responsible in this world, because you can put a question mark after it. Is this true? Let's check it out. You know, if you see someone sitting giving a Dharma talk in a blue shirt, and a thought arises, that's the wrong color for a Dharma talk. You know, this is really lousy shirt to be sitting in. How could Gil have not known and made such a terrible mistake? But you have this thought arise, but to see that thought arise, look at that. Is that really true? That Gil is a terrible teacher because he has a blue shirt? Let's question this. And this is a silly example, but it's not silly what we do in the world to each other. The amount of bias, prejudice, stereotyping, quick decisions we make about people, and we believe them. Of course we do things like this, but wow, to be quiet enough to see the thought arise and not believe it, to question it. To see it, know it as an arising thought that wasn't there before, gives you this ability to question it, to say, wait a minute, what is this? And then take a second look. Is this really true? I do this frequently, and then Very occasionally it's true, but whatever I'm thinking, but often it's not. Often it's different than what I was assuming. It's very valuable to question it and take a second look and to really see what's going on. So we see ourselves too. We can make up stories about ourselves, we interpret ourselves. And you can watch the thought arise about ourselves. And we can put a question mark after it. What is this? Is this true? So when you come to the stage of disenchantment, there are kind of five levels of that too, that I made up. But not just as a fantasy, but kind of for some purpose of exploration, purpose of deeper inquiry into understanding ourselves. And the first level is just simply noticing we're doing it. This is like the fundamental aspect of mindfulness, just be mindful of it. Oh look, there's a thought, there's an idea. There's an interpretation. And then to question it. What is this? Why am I so invested in? Why am I leaning into it? Why am I holding on to it? Why am I insisting that I have to tell everyone else this thing? Why is it so important? Why am I so captured by it? Why am I pushed around by it? Why do I have so much anger with this thought? Why do I have so much desire with it? What is this thought? So to question it. And the ability to both see these things is so much stronger. See and question after we have a lot of steadiness, peacefulness, joy, well-being. And we're beginning to see things clearly as they come into being. We see the comings and goings of things. And we see, for example, that in the comings and goings of the ever-changing, that these illusions, these enchantments we have, these ideas we have, are a kind of stepping out of the stream of change. It's a kind of taking things as being, having some constancy, some solidity. And we've kind of made this part of the fantasy is to remove it from the world of change into the world of this is how things really are. This is it for now. And so to be able to see the movements of becoming, the constant stream of change, we can feel that we have wind drag. We can feel that we put our hand out the window and now we feel that the air being pushing against us, we're creating wind drag for the car, maybe. We can feel that sometimes that we've now pulling an anchor behind us, walking on dry land. Because it's heavy, it's hard, it's now there's work going on to have this illusion and to live in it and to reinforce it and to believe it and to be contracted around it and caught in it. So to start seeing and feeling what's going on here and be able to question it. And have a contrast to be able, this is the third level, to do something that's very unpopular in Vipassana, I think. I think you're not supposed to do this. So you can just say I'm a heretic. You compare. You do an act of comparing. When you're peaceful and calm, and now you decided that the right thing to do is really to make sure that the next time you come in a retreat, everyone's wearing a blue shirt. That's really the right way to be. And Gil's doing it, so it must be it. And so this is going to make IRC really good. Blue shirts for everybody, little uniforms, kind of like monks. It'd be great, you know, and we'll all get more easily into samadhi because we're all having this commonality, and we're all part of the same tribe. It'll be great, blue. But you've watched how your peace started to vanish. You were at ease, you were at peaceful, you were settled. And then as the mind picks up this fantasy and how important it is, you see the contraction, you see the agitation, you see it all. And you can compare. Wait a minute, it was like this, and now it's like this. It was good, and now it's worse. If there's any one saying from the coming out of Dharma practice, is don't make it worse. Just don't make it worse. So you can see that I'm making it worse. I was peaceful, I was calm, I was settled. And now I've lost it. I'm involved in something. And more important in terms of comparison is it's actually better if I don't do this. So you might be able to choose not to do it, not to get involved. Or if you do get involved, you can choose to not be involved. And this is making a choice, choosing. So there's comparing and there's choosing. Or choosing maybe is too strong a word, but it might be that it's a choice to no longer invest yourself in the illusion that you have. To say, I don't believe this. Yes, it's powerful. There's a lot of forces in my mind and heart that are keeping these going. I don't understand all the forces of delusion and fantasies, but I don't stand by it. I'm not going to live in it. I'm not committed to it. Just that can make a huge difference. I'm going to step away from it. Or maybe you can let go of it. Or maybe you can return to just mindfulness practice that just knows it carefully and mindfully. And just the mindfulness practice helps it to loosen. One of the enchantments that I had in practice was that if I just practiced really well, I could make things go away. Make things better, get myself in good, wonderful states. I used to have the bazooka approach to mindfulness. If I just, you know, blasted it with mindfulness, I would just blast it out of existence, whatever. Doesn't really work. But I thought it worked. I had this illusion that I could do that. I had the illusion if I just huffed and puffed, if I brought really good mindfulness or really good concentration, that'll do it. And occasionally it does it. And then you just believe it even more. It could have just been coincidence. But I gave myself credit. But what I think one of the really powerful things in this practice for me was to see that there is a level, a time and place, where I have to create the conditions for change. I have to be mindful in an open, relaxed way and really be honest and see what's here, not be for and against it, anything. And then if I'm really there in this quiet, clear, open way, something changes that I don't make happen. I didn't make the change. I didn't let go. But something let go of it. Something shifted. Something opened. Some kind of samadhi arose. And so one of the things I then became in a healthy way disenchanted with was me as the controller, me as the doer, me as the maker, me as the one who was going to fix things or make things better. And there was a lot of illusions about me as the actor, me as the practitioner, illusions about me as the victim, me as the experiencer, me as the... Just a whole list of me's that were operating. And because I saw so often how if I got that out of the way, things worked so much better. The Dharma unfolded. And slowly I got disillusioned with this whole mental construct of me and my responsibility, my doing, my capacities to make change this way. The deepest change in the Dharma is not something you can do. And so, but even before that, so wonderful to see that you can just, you have a very important role to be really present, really be there, really be there, seeing one thing through to the end, but not the one who's going to do the change. Let the Dharma knows what needs to happen better than you. And so to trust the Dharma knows, but you have to be present. So this disenchantment, we do have a role there. We have a role to notice how we live in illusions. We have a role to question the mental constructs we have and ideas, attitudes. We have a role in comparing the healthy states that we've experienced versus the state we have. Which one do we want to invest in? Which one is the fork in the road we want to follow? And maybe you can relax, maybe you can let go sometimes. If you can, wonderful. But maybe you just step back, make a bigger picture, and just see very clearly. The choice is to see very clearly, this is an illusion. Boy, am I enchanted. And one of the things that's amazing is to realize that we're enchanted with suffering. That we can invest a lot of value, importance to suffering. There can be a lot of conceit that happens around suffering that we construct. This suffering says something about me. This suffering is about me. This suffering that means I'll be a better me if I can just not have it. I'll have a wonderful life. I'll win the lottery. You know, it's all kinds of things. But this... We can live and have a lot of delusions about suffering itself, what it means, who we are in relationship to it, how wonderful our life will be without it, the cause of it, the solution for it. Can be a lot of suffering, a lot of illusions. And so this idea of becoming disenchanted with suffering, to no longer have illusions, no longer have made-up ideas, and let suffering become ordinary. To let suffering become simple. To become disenchanted with suffering is not to make suffering worse, not to build suffering upon suffering. And then there might be the time and day, time and place where some of our suffering fades away, some of our illusions disappear so clearly that we go, wow. Kind of like I stepped across, those tourists step across that middle line in this meditation hall, and I was just blown away at what vanished from my mind. It was this construct that lived in my mind that suddenly just was gone. Wow. That's possible? Wow. Or after 7 months of thinking about I was going to be the lunch cook, And then one moment, wow. Not only was I humbled, but wasted my youth, but I also was, wow, that just vanished from my mind. Where did it go? Never to have those thoughts again. Wow. It's kind of a sacred absence. So as we practice, there's all these different ways that will be sooner or later become disenchanted. And rather than being discouraged by that, there's a wisdom in knowing that this is what happens. And the core area that it circles around is to have wisdom about non-clinging. To be disenchanted with all clinging. Every possible clinging, become completely disenchanted. See that it's all based on illusions when we cling. And that's one of the core wisdoms in Buddhism. You don't have to have a lot of wisdom, knowledge wisdom. You don't have to study a lot of books to develop wisdom in Buddhism. The real wisdom is the wisdom of clinging and the end of clinging. Clinging and how unsatisfactory it is to cling. How unsatisfying it is to cling. And to become disenchanted with clinging. And sometimes it's to become sick and tired of it. Enough already can be a healthy move. Okay, enough already. And so there's other forms of disenchantment that happen in practice as well. Generally, all disenchantments point to something wonderful if it involves two things. Either letting go or being inspired or determined or inspired or determined to become free. Free of clinging. Free of the suffering. So the disenchantment that leads us, the absence of disenchantment that leads us to really saying yes, let's take this through all the way to the end. Yes, let's become free. Free of clinging. And to end this talk with two words, maybe what this whole talk was pointing to, the two-word sentence. Trust peace. Trust peace. Thank you.